Good afternoon. We are still on 1307-1313. Is there anyone else who is present who wishes to speak on either one of those rules petition? Hearing no one, I will turn to rebuttal. Mr. Levine, according to my notes, you've agreed you will go first and then a representative of the State Bar.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make a couple quick points. It was pointed out by George Brown this morning that usually the State Bar is a very deliberative body, and it usually considers items as important as this in a three-step process where something is introduced. The first step is it's a reporting item where whatever committee or group has drafted a proposal will report to the body on what it is and give it a heads up that this is coming up in the future. The second step, it's brought up as a discussion item where it's discussed by the Board of Governors, and there's a full vetting of all different aspects of whatever's involved, but there's no vote taken until the next meeting when it's up not only for more discussion, but for action for a vote. So George is right. It can take 4 months. It can take 6 months sometimes. In this case, you'll notice from the minutes that were provided to you, it was introduced as just a reporting item. But immediately there was a motion made to kick it up to an immediate action item. So this was a proposal where it was introduced at the same meeting and action was taken at one meeting. And perhaps this is the one exception that proves the rule that a usually deliberative body decided to take immediate action. The other point that I wanted to make is in response to both some of the discussion by Mr. Delasto and Ms. Howell, that the bar feels it's very important, and there are some instances where exercise of First Amendment rights are an appropriate reason for removing someone from the Board of Governors. This is an integrated bar. It really pains me when I hear lawyers say that, because the First Amendment is irrelevant. The First Amendment has no value when people are engaging in conduct or speech that everybody agrees with, that everybody thinks is a good idea, that nobody has any objection to. It only has value where someone is saying something or belonging to a group that people think is obnoxious or foolish or a bad idea. And how lawyers can just say it's important for us to have the right to remove someone for exercise of First Amendment rights, I don't understand that, because I think it's just a core value that lawyers especially should have, to respect First Amendment rights, whether they agree with them or not. I think you had a question about that 92% vote. I didn't quite understand if it wasn't cleared up, if you wanted to ask that again, Justice Bradley.
Thank you. I merely asked for a different interpretation or an alternative view, but didn't get one. So. Yeah.
I don't know if I can tell you why each individual member who was there voted against it, but all I know is the amendment was introduced, there was a vote on it. It was 34-3, which turns out 92% of the Board of Governors, deliberative body, decided to vote against protecting the First Amendment rights of members of the Board of Governors.
Any other comments or questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Ms. Howell, since you're rising, I assume you're going to make the rebuttal. Pardon me? Oh, I said since you were standing up and approaching the podium, I assume you're going to do the rebuttal.
I am, Your Honor.
All right.
A couple of important points. I want to start with this morning, Mr. Levine indicated that the court really had three alternatives here. One was to reject the petition in its entirety. One was to essentially, quote, give the bar what it asked for, i.e., allow for removal only for revocation or suspension of a lawyer's license, or finally to amend the rule consistent with his suggestion with respect to the First Amendment. And I wanted to start with addressing that. In particular, I want to focus on the whole idea that somehow limiting removal power to revocation or suspension would solve the problem here. And I think the answer to that is it wouldn't, because as this court knows, there are at least three members of the Board of Governors who are not lawyers. They are members of the board that are appointed by this court, non-lawyer members, to serve. And while, like with every other member of the Board of Governors in the board's history to date, none of them have ever engaged in any misbehavior that would lead to someone to believe that they needed to be removed, that possibility exists for them just as it does for the lawyer members of the Board of Governors. And therefore, simply limiting removal to those whose licenses are revoked or suspended would not completely address the problem. Second, with respect to the amendment to address the First Amendment rights and the comment you made just now, Justice Walsh, and I apologize that I got through part of the answer and I didn't complete it, so I will do it now. And that is that consistent with the argument made earlier that First Amendment rights, while crucial and very important, are not absolute. And that is, I believe, one reason why a number of members, I don't know what was in the minds of those people, but lawyers are smart people. They know what the First Amendment means. They know how important it is. And I believe that that was probably an important consideration for a number of them, is that there are remedies. If, in fact, the First Amendment is violated, there is a remedy. An action can be brought. A constitutional challenge can be made. But First Amendment rights are not absolute, and they need to be considered in the context of the specific circumstances of a particular situation where the rights of the entity to whom the members of the Board of Governors and the officers of the bar owe fiduciary duties and those First Amendment rights balanced against those fiduciary duties and the interests of the organization. A couple of other things I want to respond to from this morning. Again, with respect to the First Amendment, I may have misspoken, and if I did, I apologize, Justice Gableman. You asked a question and made a comment about members of the Board of Governors as state employees or being treated as state employees. And I hope that that's not what I said, or I hope that if it was,
no,
I misspoke.
And I said you did not say that. I said that members of the Board of Governors, for some purposes, are treated as government employees, but that employees of the state bar itself are not.
That's
what I understood your response to be, and that's what I indicated to the person I was questioning.
Great. I thought maybe I had misspoke, so I wanted to make sure we were clear on that. Third, I want to respond to some of the comments that were made by Mr. Kammer this morning and make sure that the factual record is complete. And Mr. Brown is here as well and can assist me if I get any of these details wrong, but I think I've got them straight. Addressing the issue of the payroll that Mr. Kammer said he asked to see but wasn't allowed to see. In fact, what happened is the board, because they set the payroll for the employees at the bar, had a lot of information about payroll. Categories, what ranges of pay were within various categories, what specific titles were within each of those categories, et cetera. What they did not have was a list by name of each employee and what each employee was paid. As we just talked about, state bar employees are not state employees, and so when the request was made, particularly in the context because it was made at the same time that the request for email addresses for all the members of the bar were made, there was a concern for the public or the private information of the state bar employees. And so the objection was made. There was a discussion by the bar, and the bar ultimately changed its policy to make that very detailed person-by-person information available to officers of the bar to come look at. That information was offered to President Kammer while he was the president of the bar, and he did not come look at it. With respect to the email kerfluffle, I'm going to call it, I guess, because once you know the rest of the facts, I think that's really what it was, is there's a confusion between two different policies at issue. State Bar had a policy of not giving out members' email addresses electronically, in part because members had objected strenuously to that in the past. They were concerned that their email addresses were being sold, were being used for spam, et cetera. And so the bar simply did not give them out that way. What the bar did do in a separate policy was if a member of the Board of Governors wanted to communicate with each of the members in their district, they could provide that whatever it was that they wanted to communicate to the bar, and the bar would send it out to all members on their behalf in that district. So the ability to communicate electronically was there. It simply was the email addresses were not provided. Among other reasons, email addresses changed pretty significantly, and by providing the information to the bar when a specific communication was sent out, they would have the most up-to-date information. Two, once an electronic file is out there, it's very easy for it to be disseminated beyond the original intended recipient. And given the members' objections to the availability of their emails, the bar felt it was good policy not to simply make it available to people. So they're really two different things. The policy about Board of Governors communications and the policy about giving out email addresses of everybody generally were two different things, and so I wanted to make sure that was clear. On the bylaw procedure, I think that one was clear, but I want to make sure everybody understood on the referendum about the mandatory voluntary bar. There is a very, complicated is too strong of a word. There's a very specific procedure in the bar's rules and bylaws for referendums of the membership of the bar, and that procedure was what was followed in that case. And, in fact, by a vote of the Board of Governors, the board decided not to do that. It was a full-blown deliberative process where there was debate, and that the vote went against President Kammer. I don't want to get petty or anything, but I do want to make it clear. You asked a question, Justice Gableman, about the majority of the bar members saying that they were for voluntary bar by voting for Mr. Kammer. In fact, Mr. Kammer was elected by 35% of the bar membership in a three-way election, so he was not elected by a majority. He got the most votes of any of the three candidates, but it was not a majority vote.
Too late noted.
The last point I want to make is that there was a lot of discussion this morning about, you know, can we somehow give people a list of what kind of behavior we want to make sure everyone understands is not appropriate and is grounds for removal. And I think the comments that Mr. Brown made later on about a past president where there were issues kind of illustrates the issue that over time expectations change, what's acceptable behavior and what's not acceptable behavior changes. And at any point in time, while you might have a pretty good list, especially if you throw a catch-all in, which is essentially what we started with here is the catch-all, you might have a pretty good list. As community expectations change and what's considered appropriate behavior will also change. And maybe this court would like to be involved in this kind of debate on a regular basis as people try to amend the rule to adjust to those changing expectations. But I have a sneaking suspicion you have far more important things to be worried about, and that giving, no matter how you put a list together, you're going to have a catch-all at the end. And if you have a catch-all to begin with, I think you end up in the same place. And so I think the way that the bar has done this, given the procedural protections that are in place to go with this, does provide the protection and the notice, particularly combined with the Supreme Court's own rules on what the purposes of the bar are to protect members' rights, and that adopting the bylaw and the rules as petitioned by the bar is appropriate and should be done. Thank you.
Any questions of Ms. Howell? Okay. Hearing none, thank you. And I want to thank all the persons who have appeared and those who have submitted written materials for the helpfulness on these petitions for the court's review. This concludes our hearing in 1307 and 1313. And I will move on to our public hearing on Rule Petition 1309 in the matter of the petition of the State Bar of Wisconsin proposing revisions in SCR 10033 and 10035 relating to classes of membership and membership dues and reduction of dues. This will be presented by President Patrick Fiedler. And the other appearances I have noted here are John F. Wilcox, President-elect, Seniors Lawyer Division, George Brown, Executive Director, Linda Tanner, Assistant Executive Director, Stephen Levine, Raymond Dalsto, and Keith Saline. We'll start with you, Attorney Patrick Fiedler, President of the State Bar.
Thank you very much. As President of the State Bar, I believe that one of our most important roles is to ensure that our members are able to take full advantages of all the benefits of State Bar membership, regardless of age or financial status in life. It's our responsibility as advocates of this profession to make sure that our attorneys are equipped with the necessary tools to succeed, especially those first starting out in their careers and those who are winding down. Petition 1309, which would extend dues relief to our newest members and expand membership options within our emeritus community, is a step in the right direction. With ever-increasing tuitions and a tightening job market, we recognize the continuing economic strain on our newer members. Equally important is ensuring the bar provides services to our most experienced members as they continue to practice. These members know that their contributions are directly supporting the State Bar's many and diverse programs and services that are easily accessible and legally meaningful. Both the emeritus and active new proposals should be adopted for the following reasons. As it relates to the emeritus proposal, the State Bar believes, as a matter of policy and fairness, the cost of services provided to the practicing attorney should be shared by those who have chosen to continue to practice, even those who have reached the age of 70. The Board of Governors has chosen this two-tiered approach to give attorneys who are perhaps winding down their practices the opportunity to pay less than full dues. Nearly all members of the Senior Lawyers Division Board voted to support this petition with one exception. One member said that the proposal did not go far enough and that as long as an attorney actively practices law, he or she should be paying full dues. This proposal is even more modest than what we had discussed in 2004. That proposal would have increased the emeritus age to 75 with no special dues reduction for an attorney who has not yet reached that age. 160 active members will be eligible to select either active emeritus or senior emeritus status in fiscal year 2015. As to active new members, the State Bar does have a process by which members can request a waiver of dues for personal hardship. The organization, along with the board, felt it's imperative to recognize those attorneys who are new to the practice. The board felt the most prudent method for implementation of the dues reduction would be to treat all members of the active new class equally, rather than requiring individuals to disclose personal compensation information. The board received a report from our new lawyers task force, and according to that report, which is entitled Challenges Facing New Lawyers Task Force Report and Recommendations, new lawyers welcomed the dues relief. Many participants in the task force listening sessions were delighted to hear that steps are being taken to reduce dues and assessments. Statistics from the American Bar Association show that nationwide, only 55% of the class of 2011 had full-time long-term jobs that required a law degree 9 months after graduation. New statistics released in the Young Lawyers Division report show that among the 600 young lawyers surveyed, 72% of whom graduated from law school since 2008, nearly 80% reported that they were earning less than expected in law school, and lawyers in this group had an average law practice compensation of about $41,000. More than half the respondents in the task force survey reported that as a result of having law school debt, they had delayed a major purchase, had their happiness impaired, made suboptimal career choices, delayed marriage or having children, requested a forbearance or deferment, or found it difficult to pay bar dues or court fees.
You know, your request says you don't want to ask these young lawyers how much money they're making or whether they're happy or whether they're practicing law. You don't want to get into what's the practice of law issue. On the other hand, as to lawyers 70 and older, at least for some, you say, did you have 800 billable hours? And you don't look behind that. You just say, hey, whatever they say, the end. So why can't you ask a general question of the young lawyers and whatever they say, the end? And if they qualify for no dues or half dues, swell. Do you know what I mean? Rather than just knocking out 2 years of these lawyers.
Full dues?
What?
Knocking out 2 years of the
yeah,
full lawyers.
Full dues, because you can't figure out a way to separate them out. You figured out a way for the older lawyers. You trust them more than the younger lawyers?
No, that certainly is not.
That's an interest against the question against my self-interest. But
well, as it is mine, because while someday I'll be eligible for the benefit of emeritus status, I'll never be eligible for the benefit of young lawyer status. So in that regard, these were things that really were looked at separately. And quite honestly, I think one of the messages that the State Bar is attempting to impart here is to new lawyers that we are aware of the concerns that they have raised, and we want to at least make some type of movement toward alleviating some of that pain. What I always think back to is because when the Young Lawyers Task Force report was given, the chairs were Art Harrington and Sherry Coley, and that was at a recent board meeting. And Art Harrington had read representative samples of some of the comments that were given by young lawyers who responded to the survey. They talked in terms of being depressed, regretted having made the decision to go to law school, regretted having made the decision to become a lawyer. I go back to when I got out of law school in 1980. I borrowed the maximum, went to Marquette, obviously a private law school, and that was $15,000. And given cost of living, that was something that I could budget for. And I took the maximum period of time to pay that off, which was 10 years. So that, for me, was very doable. Talking in terms of some of today's lawyers with debt approaching high five numbers or sometimes over $100,000, frankly, I can understand why they were discouraged. That's certainly not a feeling that I had 34 years ago because I saw a light at the end of the tunnel as it relates to debt. Also, I'm convinced that the job market was much better back then than it is today. So could we have them self-report? That is one of the things that we could do. Rather, I feel it's a better practice to indicate to them as a new group that we are going to give you a break as a member of the State Bar for the first 5 years.
Can I ask, the equivalent billable hours label has me wondering, what do you mean by that?
Right.
Do you bill it? Some law firms, you have people who still work, but they can't technically bill. Like some of the larger ones have mandatory retirement ages. I'm not sure exactly what that age is or how that fits in. So they really can't bill, but they might still work on cases, or they might give advice, or they might count. I don't know how that works. So is that the equivalent or not, or what?
The way I look at it is I think it's the equivalent between full-time and half-time. When we talk about 800 hours, we were assuming that it's probably typical for somebody in private practice to have the expectation to be billing 1,600 hours per year if they are practicing full-time. So we simply have that. Let's assume that they are not in private practice but some other type of employment. I think it would relate to are they working full-time or part-time in that regard. So
you define that, though. I mean, I guess that's my question. Do you actually have to bill a client to count it as a billable hour? Or does it have to be the equivalent of, if you were still allowed to bill, that would be the equivalent of a billable hour? See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do see what you're saying. And potentially that, again, would be one of those standards that's in the eye of the beholder. To me, it would mean, am I working half-time that is no more than the equivalent of 800 billable hours per year, or am I working more than that?
Why don't you just say half-time versus full-time?
Well, half-time,
because you may not be working in the practice of law for billable hours. You might be a developer.
Right.
You might be a land use planner of some sort.
And or you might still be at a law firm, but you may not be allowed under that firm's policy to bill hours.
Right. Well, in that.
So what does that mean?
To me, that would mean, are you working the equivalent of 800 hours or more or 800 hours or less?
A year.
Correct. And this is another area where it's self-reporting for a lawyer, but, I, you know, that it's not without precedent that lawyers, I think, self-report on a lot of things that they're required to do.
You know, I don't really understand why you have active emeritus. You still pay the full dues, and you just have to be working, you know, more than 800 hours a year. What's the difference if you're 70 or if you're 55? I don't really understand why you have that category. You don't get any reduction in dues, according to what I'm looking at.
All right. You're right. This would be a change that would raise it from 70 to 75 as it relates to full emeritus status. And I think part of the reasoning behind that relates to some lawyers are choosing to practice longer in their careers than perhaps has been done in the past.
Yeah, but why give them a so what? I mean, why give them a classification as active emeritus? You don't give them anything for the classification except they label themselves how old they are, which I'm sure you probably know from the records anyway. So I don't get why you need that as a sixth classification.
All right. I am assuming that that came about as a result of the fact that presently we have emeritus and we're distinguishing between them. As it relates to this, is going to be the next step.
Let's see. Do you have to go to active emeritus before you can be senior emeritus? It doesn't say that.
No. At age 70, you could select either active or senior, depending
on
your...
I don't really get why you'd want to have active, but that's fine. I just didn't see the purpose of it.
Thank you.
Active emeritus with 800 billable hours or more, full dues and full assessment. This is my gyp sheet. Senior emeritus, 70 to 74, less than 800 billable hours, half dues, half assessments, $50 yearly assessment, right?
Right.
Over 75, no matter what your billable hours, no dues, right?
Correct.
You practice less than 5 years, you get half dues. What about assessments?
I would have to have a chart in front of me on that.
I know. I couldn't figure it out.
I know that Mr. Celine is here, and he'll be better prepared to address that than I am.
Okay, because I just didn't know. And this has a grandfather provision for lawyers. So if you're now, if you were 70 this year, when this becomes in effect, and you are emeritus and therefore pay no dues, even if you bill more than 800 hours, you're grandfathered in.
Correct.
Why?
There has to be a cutoff point somewhere, and that seems as logical to me as anything else. I cannot foresee a situation where, because of the present structure, we've indicated to someone you have emeritus status, you don't have to pay any dues, and then we take that away from them.
Year do you figure these $800 billable hours? The bar's fiscal year, the lawyer's fiscal year, an annual year?
That's not set forth. To me, it would be starting the bar's fiscal year every July 1 when a lawyer has to fill out the form for bar dues, et cetera, trust accounts, everything else.
Okay,
that
so
to me would be the
most
logical.
So it's the bar's fiscal year.
Correct.
Okay.
Would the rules say the same thing if the word equivalent were out of there? I don't mean will it say the same thing because the word equivalent wouldn't be in there, but I mean would it have the same effect? Do you need the word equivalent of? That to me gives you a sense of ambiguity that would be clearer without it in there. I'm trying to figure out if there's an objection to that.
You know, that's to my...
Because it says different things in different spots, and the chief's questions assume you bill 800. That's an easy standard. Do you bill 800 or not? But the equivalent of 800 billable hours seems different to me.
I do not know if that issue was ever brought up, but I think the language the way it is right now is probably the most clear that it could be to a lawyer as it relates to if you're going to bill at X amount, this is what your dues are going to be.
Okay. So the equivalent could be out.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I've asked this question at a prior hearing, and I'm going to revisit it. You started your comments at the earlier rules hearing with the State Bar is dedicated to do everything in its power to protect its members, and then you talked about that we want to have policies that promote sensible policies. Here is my fact situation. It dovetails with Emeritus and the petition we have here, and it causes me concern. Let's say there was an attorney in Highland. Is Highland in Iowa County? That's where you hail from,
it's,
that area. Let's say
they were in our conference.
Yeah, they're in your conference. Okay. Let's say you, an attorney in Highland retires at 65, goes to Arizona to play golf. Has a couple of kids, one of the major attorneys, one of the few attorneys in Highland, Wisconsin, on the bank board, just Mr. Community, and is proud as proud can be to be an attorney. That's what his identity is. He even has a license plate, probably, attorney or something. So 65, he retires. And he goes to Arizona, and he really does retire. He, because he is invested in being an attorney, he's on inactive status, which means he pays one half of his dues and has paid one half of his dues. And then lo and behold, the Supreme Court, on petition of the State Bar, enacts a rule that says, hey, if you want to be emeritus status, you've got to get up to snuff on all your CLEs. So this person doesn't practice law, doesn't want to practice law, just wants to have the proud badge of being a lawyer. You know, he wants the obituary to say, you know, lawyer. So now, with our rather complex procedures. So now he will, in order to be emeritus, he first, even though he's been inactive, has no desire to practice law, none whatsoever. So now to get to emeritus status, he has to go from inactive to active. And he has to take 60 credit hours of CLE, pay for them, attend them. Still no desire to practice law, still in Arizona. And now, he's been kind of waiting, you know, boy, I'll hit 70, I won't have to pay anything. Well, now the bar has been moved. So he hits 70, and he, even though he's not practicing, he has to pay either full or half dues until 75. There's something to me that doesn't make sense about that. For someone who doesn't want to practice, who has no desire to practice, just wants to continue with the pride of being a lawyer. That's the system that we've set up for him, and the cost. That makes no sense. Why can't there be some kind of a fail-safe, some kind of a safe harbor for people who have no desire to practice whatsoever, just want to continue to carry the proud badge of being a lawyer?
Well, apparently, though, that lawyer's made a particular choice to go with an active status, which means he is still a member of the State Bar, can carry the proud badge of being a lawyer, simply as an active status. And it's a very good example, but that lawyer has made a particular choice at a particular point in their career as it relates to what status they want to have.
Sure, but what he has to go through in terms of the hoops. He's inactive, but if he wants to get to emeritus, he's got to become active and pay for 60 credit hours of CLE. That's not in this rule. This is another rule
right.
that we passed, but it interfaces with this rule. And then he gets to be emeritus, right? And then he's still not practicing. He hasn't come back to Wisconsin for years. But now he has to pay 800 or he has to pay half or full. Now, he would pay the half because he's not practicing. And then at age 75, be entitled to have to continue membership without payment. This doesn't make sense to me, that you'd have to go from inactive, in his case, when there's a situation where there is no inclination, desire to ever practice law anywhere again.
I don't think that that is protecting your members or promoting sensible policies.
Well, and I appreciate your position on that. Again, what I'm back to, he has made a choice to do so. I think what you're suggesting then is that the bar should consider perhaps having changing language, which is presently in existence, that would indicate that somebody can go from inactive to emeritus. I'm not certain that that would then be limited to the example you've given of the lawyer from Highland who's 65 years of age. Potentially it could be somebody who gets out of law school, is never really active practicing law, but does other things, takes inactive status at age 25, and then either at 70 or 75 should be able to go to emeritus without switching their status back to active. I'm trying to see where where we draw the line there.
That just seems unfair and doesn't make sense to me, that fact situation. The second concern I have is this. As I understand it, that this will result in 142,000 decrease in revenue or some kind of figure like that. My concern is in a year from now or 2 years from now, when the state bar comes to us and asks us for a $40 or $50 increase in dues, and we say no, what are you going to do?
All right. Well, Linda Tan is here, and when it is her turn, I would ask that she give you the specific financial figures because she's got them at the tips of her fingers.
The bar doesn't have to come here to raise dues, does it?
That was my understanding that we don't.
Thanks.
We have to come here to change, request a change in status, but not as it relates to dues. My understanding is, according to the most recent numbers I've been given, if this court were to pass this as proposed in its entirety, the decrease in revenues for the bar would be just under $100,000, offsetting what we're not receiving from the expansion of new members and then adding to that what we would be receiving from the change in definition of emeritus.
I must have been confusing Mr. Saleem, and I say that tongue-in-cheek. So, yes, I'm sorry. My premise was incorrect.
And, you know, raising dues, whether or not it has to come this court or not, is always something that, frankly, can get emotional times as it relates to discussions that takes place among the board members.
And its deliberative body. Okay.
You know, I'll be honest with you on that. Whether they're raised or not, I can guarantee you that we do not make all members of the board of that particular year happy with whatever the final decision is.
Now, I'm still trying to read 10.035 to see if people who are not been admitted for 5 years have to pay all these assessments, but we'll ask. Okay. Any other comments, Mr. Fiedler?
I have none, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Wilcox.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice and Justices. First, I'd like to make a correction. I am not the Honorable John F. Wilcox.
No, I know that because your name is spelled J-O-H-N.
Yes.
And his is J-O-N.
Instead of P.
And the middle initial isn't correct.
I don't remember.
And I'm
initial.
Not entitled to the title.
Well, we think you're honorable anyway.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And I've known you a long time. Practiced law with your brother.
Yes.
Also with your father on cases.
As you see from the sheet, I am the president-elect of the Senior Lawyers Division of the State Bar. At a meeting last year, the board voted to support this petition. That position of the board of the Senior Lawyers Division was in some senses a compromise. There was a strong feeling on the part of the board, in fact so strong that one of the members voted contrary to the recommendation because he felt, as all of the board did, that people who continue to practice law should pay for the services that they are availing themselves of through the state bar to some extent. On the other hand, the rules allowed people who were 70 years of age or older to opt out of paying those dues by electing emeritus status. The board felt that some of those people had made that choice in part for economic reasons, and that it would be unfair to then say, we're changing that rule. You reached 72 years ago, 2 years ago, and made that election. Now we're going to require you, if you want to retain emeritus status, to pay dues. So the grandfathered provision, the board felt, was a reasonable way to address that. Lastly, the board felt that the additional monies generated by the dues that are paid by people who otherwise, under the existing rule, could have elected emeritus status, would have the potential of assisting those people in adjusting to retirement when they elected to do that through programs, etc. The section has, or the division rather, has been active in promoting educational programs or programs to allow people to, tell people of services that are available to them in assisting in winding things down or in retirement. So for all of those reasons, the division felt that this was a good proposal and one that merited approval by this court. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
How many people are members of the senior division?
Pardon?
How many members are there in the senior division? Maybe everybody of a particular age.
Well, you don't automatically become a member. You have to elect to join it, the section, or the division, rather. I don't remember, Your Honor, just exactly what the number is. I believe it's something in the vicinity of 2,000, but it may be more or less than that number.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions or comments?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. Brown.
May it please the court, I'm here to answer any questions. I think I can address the issue that Justice Bradley was raising regarding inactive to emeritus. First of all, we have to remember that that is always a choice. And in fact, some members choose not to become emeritus simply because they don't want to telegraph their age to their clients. The other thing is that it used to be that you could go from inactive to emeritus with no issues. Remember, emeritus is considered an active status. But a number of years ago when we came before this body with regard to clarification about what judicial membership meant, because there are individuals who are selecting personally to become judicial when in fact under many interpretations they were not considered judicial, and all the consequences that came from that, one of the issues that came up, which was brought to the body that was assembled for that purpose, was brought by then BBE Director Casabucci, who said that he knew of instances, in fact, fairly regular instances of individuals who had been inactive and, in fact, lived and worked out of state for up to 40 years, were moving back to Wisconsin to retire, had always been inactive their entire life, and then because they were over 70 could become active and therefore practice law without having known Wisconsin law for the last 40 years. And so then the change was made so that you had to go to the BBE. If you were inactive, you had to go to the BBE and get approval for CLE purposes in order to become emeritus because you were becoming active. One of the unintended consequences of that is individuals, as you described, Justice Bradley. So I've been in discussions with the BBE about that, and we haven't come to any solution yet.
If you're a young lawyer, less than 5 years, you pay half the dues. Do you pay all of the assessments?
No, half the assessments as well.
Half the assessments and the $50 assessment?
I believe that's true, yes.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions for Mr. Brown? if you kept the, and maybe I could calculate it, but if you kept the young lawyers where they are, how much would be gained by the movement from emeritus to active and senior?
Well, we're estimating, and that's all we can do. We're estimating about half the individuals would choose one of those categories, and so that we would gain about $20,000, $20,000 to $30,000.
So you gain $20,000.
The net would be in the 90s.
Emeritus, and you lose from the...
Right. So the net would be around $95,000. Net loss would be around $95,000.
Which then about $120,000 is your loss from the young people.
Right.
You gain 20 and your net is 100, then your loss has to be 120.
Right. Right.
Mathematically.
Right.
And that's over how many people do you suggest on that? Your dues are roughly $225.
Right.
Roughly.
$224.
So that would be, the young lawyers would save $112 a year. Plus
on our dues, plus half
plus
the
half
assessments
the
as well, right. Yeah.
And then we'll hear from Mr. Selene, I hope, about what the loss would be to his budget.
Right. And what happens is that we work up to what we call a full dues equivalent number. So here's what we believe will be the number of active members, inactive members, emeritus, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then the dollar amount that will be generated by that, and we calculate that backwards to create a number that we call the full dues equivalent. In other words, what would be the number of individuals if they were all paying full dues that would reach this total number? And currently, without any changes as being presented to you, we would be looking at about $20,250, I think. I'm sorry.
Why do I
number
care?
Number of full dues equivalent members. Okay, it would go from about 20,000 and a couple hundred down to about 19,750. So we'd lose about that many in dues, full dues equivalent because of any changes.
Which is roughly $100,000, I guess.
Right.
Or 120 less your gain. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Tanner.
Good afternoon. My name is Linda Tanner. I'm the Assistant Executive Director at the State Bar, and I was asked to come here today by Mr. Brown to answer any questions you had that had to do with numbers. So I don't have any remarks prepared, but certainly can answer some questions about numbers if you have them.
Well, we're glad to meet you and have you. I think this is your first appearance, or am I wrong?
You are correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about yourself, then. When did you join the bar? No, that's not the question. When did you become assistant executive director?
That was in 2006, I believe. I was hired by the bar 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What did you do before you became executive assistant director?
I was the finance director and then the administration and finance director. And then George decided to put one more little piece on it, so assistant executive director at that point in time.
You like your job?
I do. I do.
I won't ask you why. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Tanner. Mr. Levine. Okay, we need a microphone. Thank you, Mr. Fiedler.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me add that in my experience at the State Bar, there is no more competent, likable, easier to work with person than Linda Tanner. So we'll add that information
that is,
about
that's
her.
That's not germane to the topic, but since I raised it, we accept that. And listen, you get all, take all the compliments you can get. Now, what do you have to say that's negative?
I'll try to put this in a positive light.
Okay.
First.
You can't fool me.
Go ahead.
First. Are you for this or against this? Or a little bit of both?
Just like to present the court with options. I hope that the court does not do away with the status that emeritus lawyers have now. The emeritus lawyer status was established years ago as a thank you, as a gesture of appreciation, as a gift to lawyers who've reached the age of 70, who've been in many instances, lawyers for 45 years. It was a statement that thank you for your service to your community, to your clients, to the legal profession, and to the bar.
Well, they keep it. They just push it to 75. You favor keeping it at 70?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that keeping that thank you, keeping that incentive, is important to emeritus lawyers. And I think also, I guess the biggest thing that bothers me about this, first of all, what bothers me about both of these proposals concerning emeritus lawyers and new lawyers is that the bar comes to you, and basically, especially considering emeritus lawyers, this is a fiscal issue. But the bar hasn't provided for the record anything like a fiscal statement, a budget, for you to get the broad picture of what's going on with the finances of the bar. The whole proposal concerning emeritus lawyers, according to the response letter that the bar submitted to the questions posed by Commissioner Rich, said that doing away with the emeritus status or moving it to age 75 will result in about $27,000 worth of additional revenue. So for $27,000, the bar wants to take away that status from emeritus lawyers. What does that $27,000 mean? Unfortunately, I would be much more sympathetic to this proposal if the bar had come to you and said, we have a financial problem, we're doing all we can to meet it, and we're asking a little bit more of sacrifice of others, including emeritus lawyers. Unfortunately, the situation is exactly the opposite. About 4, 5, 6 years ago, when a financial crisis in the bar began to appear and people realized that something has to be done, instead of setting an example for others, the bar decided to take the opposite path. And I listed in my brief to the court on this some of what I thought was a wasteful spending that the bar has done in the past few years, that if it hadn't done, would more than make up this $27,000 that we generated by moving the emeritus lawyer designation back 5 years.
They're not going to make it up with flasks.
Pardon?
They're not going to make it up with flasks.
Not with flasks, but they are going to make it up with a couple of meetings that they have every year outside of Madison, each of which costs between $13,000 and $15,000. If you add those together, you get more than the $27,000 that the bar wants to get from emeritus lawyers. If the bar can't set an example itself of cutting back on unnecessary expenses, how can it go to emeritus lawyers and say, we want to take that designation away from you? We're not willing to sacrifice. We want to keep on spending, but we want you to sacrifice. I just don't think that's fair. As far as the proposal to reduce dues by one half for new lawyers in their fourth and fifth years of bar membership, I stated in my brief some of the technical objections as to why I think that proposal is badly written. The University of Wisconsin Law School, the latest statistics, indicate that 65% of the graduating class from 2012 got law jobs within 9 months of graduation. Another 25% have jobs that don't require bar admission. We don't know what they are. They could be anything from corporate executives to, you know, working in retail. Who knows? But much of the aid from this reduced tuition is going to go to people who don't need it, to lawyers at some of Wisconsin's biggest law firms, in many cases, it's not even going to go to these new lawyers because, as you're familiar with, the practice with many law firms is to pay the state bar dues of their members so that this break of $112 will be going to law firms rather than to the individuals that it purportedly is aimed at. The other point is, I mean, no one wants to be a Scrooge. I, just like everybody else, want to help new lawyers as much as possible. Law school tuition has become unbelievably high. But the $112 that the state bar wants to give a break for two more years turns out to be 1/7 of 1% of tuition at UW Law School. Even less at Marquette, where tuition is almost double that of UW Law School. I wish that instead of deciding to reduce its revenues by $144,000 and give each new lawyer for two more years $112, the bar decided to do something serious about law school tuitions. There was an article in the American Bar Association online last week that some law schools around the country are beginning to reduce tuition, realizing that it's gotten out of hand. The University of Iowa Law School for next year is reducing tuition by 16%. The University of Arizona by 11%. Law schools are reducing tuition. If the bar, maybe even this court, called in the deans of the law schools and said, we'd like to know, we realize the situation is getting to be a big problem. What are you doing to try to contain costs?
Well, maybe the bar ought to use the $100,000 to hire counsel for people who are underrepresented or unrepresented and are indigent. That would put the lawyers to work, give them experience, and set them up for jobs. It's $100,000, according to the bar today.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question, Your Honor. The acoustics here have not gotten better than they were the last time.
I said that perhaps $100,000 should be set aside by the bar and used to hire new lawyers to represent people who are unrepresented or underrepresented because they're indigent. That would give these new lawyers that are unemployed an opportunity to be employed in the law, get experience, and set them up for full employment.
That's another good idea. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that $112
was a plus half the assessments, and the assessments are a couple of $100, give or take some.
Okay.
So it's roughly $200.
$200 is a drop in the bucket to a law school graduate who has an average of $77,000 in debt. The real aid to new graduates and to law students who are in law school now is to get the law schools to reduce tuition. Other law schools are doing it. The law schools in Wisconsin.
We can do both.
We can
do
both.
I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, Mr. Levine.
But the problem is, given the bar's fiscal situation right now, as was mentioned, this is going to cost $144,000. And the question is, where is the bar going to come up with that money?
Are they going to cut costs?
I think they're going to raise dues.
Well, that's possible, too. You opposed to raising dues?
Pardon?
Are you opposed to raising dues?
Yes. So just in summary, I hope that the court will decide to retain the emeritus status as a reward and as a gesture of recognition for lawyers who have reached the age of 70. And I think there are other steps that can be taken to help new lawyers with the fiscal crisis of going to law school. I think that the way the bar has crafted the proposal for partial dues for lawyers in their fourth and fifth year, much of that aid is going to go to people who are employed or to their law firms who really don't need that aid.
Do we know how many of the people employed go to larger firms with substantial initial salaries. You know, most lawyers in the state are in 3 to 5 or less than.
I haven't seen a breakdown of that. No.
George Brown knows, or says he knows. All right.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Brown.
As a result of the recession and changes in how clients are willing to pay, for those of you familiar with large firm practices maybe a decade or so ago where they would hire 30, maybe even more associates, and then over time winnow them down to the 5 or 6 that may become partners today, typically large law firms in Wisconsin, if you get below about number 35, you're talking firms of 15 or less. They typically hire 1 or 2 or 3, or in this case, I understand last year, Foley & Lardner hired 5 people in Wisconsin, and with the idea that these people would eventually become partner as opposed to winnowing out everybody over time. So they're hiring far fewer, and typically what they're doing in order to grow is either they're acquiring other law firms or they're bringing in laterals who already have experience and a book of business, because clients simply are not willing to pay any longer for the training, if you will, of new lawyers.
What are the percent, as best you can estimate, of lawyers in Wisconsin in less than five, firms of less than of 5 and less, or 3 than less? You have some calculation in small firms.
Small firm of 5 or less is over 90% of our members.
You're assuming that the hiring each year now is 90% will be in firms 5 or less, or starting their
right,
own
firm. And over 70% are solo practitioners.
Of the
entire
Wisconsin
membership of the state bar, yes. Over 70%,
over 70%
are solo practitioners.
Solos. I said they were a lot, but I was low on my estimates. Mm-hmm. 3 to 5.
And if I could address an earlier issue as well, the issue of age 70 was brought up as well. And it's my understanding, although this was even before my time, believe it or not, at the time 70 was set as the emeritus, was because that was when mandatory retirement was typical, I think even especially in state service. And so just as Tsar Nicholas chose 65, as the retirement age for the serfs, and that has come forward over time. The age 70 has come forward in Wisconsin bar history as the age of emeritus, so that members who were retired from state service no longer had to pay bar dues. And that obviously has changed. The mandatory retirement has gone away, and many lawyers, more and more lawyers, are working into their 70s and even later than that.
Here's a whole chart. New 40 is 40 is new 20. 50 is new something or other. 80 is new 60. Who knows?
Not according to Louis Black, though, as he said.
Not according to what?
The comedian Louis Black, he said. 40 is not the new 60 because they're different numbers.
It's a great line. I don't listen to him, though. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. All right. I don't see Mr. DeLusto here. Is he here? He said he had to leave.
Your Honor, he's not speaking on that issue.
Okay, he's down, but he's not speaking on the issue. That's fine. I have Mr. Saleem.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Justices. It's good to be here. I wanted to communicate with you the Board of Administrative Oversight's position on this petition, and also my own, which is not exactly the same but consistent. At its December meeting, the Board of Administrative Oversight voted to oppose the petition.
Oppose
unless the revenue for the lawyer regulation system was preserved. In other words, if there was some means to ensure that the revenue would be received at the same rate, same amount, then only in that circumstance would they approve it.
They don't care if the state bar gets less money. They don't want OLR to get less money.
That's correct.
Okay.
And OLR's position is consistent with that. We believe that whether the court votes to approve the petition or not, OLR would ask the court also to protect the revenue that is required. And I wanted to let the court know that based on the full dues equivalent numbers I received from the State Bar, that there would be a difference of about 2.75% in the revenue, such that the assessment would then have to be increased 2.75%.
What's so, that flat, as best you can estimate, amount?
For the fiscal year we're in right now, 2014, I understand that the assessment would have to be increased, would have had to be increased $4.25.
Okay. But how much would you lose, in effect?
The amount of dollars we would lose?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I did not bring that calculation with me. The budget is $3,300,000, so I would just take 3% of 2.75% of that. But I could certainly get that number to you.
About $100,000, you think?
That sounds right to me. On a per-lawyer basis, it would be $4.25. And instead of the $155 assessment we have this year, it would equate to $159.25.
Yeah, figures out, because if you did $4 times 23,000, which is the rough number of lawyers,
yes,
it makes $92,000, and doing it the other way, I got 99. So that's the range of decreased revenue per year.
Per year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what's your personal view?
Well, the board's view was to protect it, and I think OLR would take that view. We would want the revenue. We need the revenue, and we would want it to be protected in whatever form. The OLR doesn't have any concern about whether the court adopts the petition or not, as long as the revenue is protected in some way.
Mm-hmm. Any questions of Mr. Saleem? Thank you, Mr. Saleem.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other people who would like to comment further on 13-09? Hearing none, I will declare that the open and rules petition conference on 13-09 in the matter of the petition of the State Bar of Wisconsin proposing revisions to 10.03.3 and 10.03.5 relating to classes of membership and dues is closed. The open rules petition hearing is now closed. The court will have a very brief recess and come out and sit in open rules petition conference. And the first order of business will be to determine what will happen with 1307, 1313, and 1309. We are in recess. Oh, we're
opportunity to the special. I have no one.